This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. George Herbert Walker Bush has a perspective on the presidency shared only by John Adams, as the father of a president who has himself occupied the Oval Office. Today's report is part of the series of presidential conversations on the Constitution, produced by public radio and television station WHYY with the National Constitution Center. NPR's Koki Roberts interviewed former President Bush about that perspective. She talked with him at his presidential library at Texas A&M University.
By the time Vice President George Bush became president in 1989, he was wise in the ways of Washington. He had served in Congress from Texas, then tried to follow in his father's footsteps by running for the Senate. After his defeat in 1970, Bush became ambassador to the United Nations, then took on the thoroughly thankless job of heading the Republican National Committee as the Watergate scandal unfolded. He remembers a phone call he received from his counterpart at the helm of the Democratic National Committee, Bob Strauss.
And my job was to try to keep the party out of the Watergate mess, because it wasn't a party effort, and yet try to defend the president where I could. And so Strauss called me up, in great lack of sympathy, I might add, and said, "Your job reminds me of making love to a gorilla." I said, "Strauss, that's very interesting. Why?" He said, "Well, you can't stop till the gorilla wants to." And so he's always reminded me of that, and I've always felt there's a little lack of compassion in the phone call. It was not the happiest time in my life.
There wasn't much to laugh about in those days. When, as head of the party, Bush found himself writing to President Nixon, urging him to resign. The next tour of duty, as envoy to China, served as a welcome respite before Bush returned home to another sticky situation, taking over a central intelligence agency that had been raked over the coals by two congressional committees. As the new CIA chief, Bush thought the committees had gone overboard in their investigations.
I realized the agency had done some things wrong, but I also know and found this to be true, particularly when I was president, that it's the executive branch, and you have to have a certain amount of secrecy if you're going to get the best intelligence. You have to deal with bad guys if you're going to get the best intelligence.
Once he became president with a Democratic majority in Congress, Bush pushed to shore up the power of the executive. He found the conduct of foreign policy, he now admits, much more fun than domestic policy because the Congress was much less involved. He was able, for example, to ignore the advice of Democratic leaders to go to Berlin to show solidarity with the forces of freedom after the wall came down.
I didn't say it at the time, but it was the stupidest idea I had ever heard of for me to stick my finger in Gorbachev's eyes when they were letting this go forward. They had legions in the GDR and I think still in Hungary and Poland. And we didn't know how the Soviet army was going to react. We didn't know whether they could possibly overthrow. We'll show the Americans. We'll get rid of Gorbachev and there were no paper tiger.
But the president did decide he needed the blessing of Congress before going to war against Iraq after a somewhat sobering conversation with fellow World War II veteran, Hawaiian Democrat Daniel Inouye.
Danny Inouye, a very respected Democrat who did oppose the war, came to me and said, "If you do this, and if it doesn't work right, you'll be impeached." I said, "Dan, you got to do what you got to do. You got to do what you think is right sometime." That was before the vote, I think. But I had such respect for him, I must say I thought about it a great deal.
The Senate vote in January 1991 to authorize war was close, 53-47, and fell almost entirely along party lines. But, the former president says, it removed the threat of impeachment following a decision to invade. And in prosecuting the war, Bush stayed within the limits of the Congressional and United Nations resolutions.
I don't believe in mission creep. I don't believe in going back on your word to the Congress. We told them what we were going to do, to the United Nations resolutions that were crafted not to capture Baghdad or not to kill Saddam, to liberate Kuwait. And we did it, and for the most part, we came home. And let the kibitzers, you know, worry about it. I think history, we're going to say, you did the right thing.
The Persian Gulf War was the political high point for the Bush administration. The low point came when Democrats forced the president to back down on his campaign promise not to raise taxes. It was one of many pitched battles between the executive and legislative branches. The fiercest was waged over the confirmation of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court and the firestorm caused by law professor Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment.
I remember Cokie walking with him on the South Lawn of the White House during the height of the debate. And I were there saying, well, do you think it'd be better for you, sir, if I withdrew? Don't you think this is hurting the president? I said it would be just the opposite. If I withdrew my support for you, it would be the terrible thing. And we have every right to see you confirmed, and you will be confirmed. I wasn't overly sure at that very moment. I walked around the South Lawn with my arm around him and said, Clarence, you just got to stay in there. And, of course, I think he was pleased to hear that he'd have that support, and the rest is history.
The former president now argues that Senate use of the filibuster on court appointments has encroached on the constitutional right of the president to name judges, since it requires 60 votes to cut off debate instead of the majority called for by the Constitution. But there's one presidential power that Congress has no say over whatsoever, the power to pardon. Just a few days before the 1992 election, the special prosecutor investigating the Iran-Contra affair indicted some key players in the Reagan and Bush administrations. Republicans believe those 11th-hour indictments helped defeat George Bush. Before he left office, he happily pardoned the men who had been indicted.
I was annoyed about the fact that it hurt me politically, but I'm very proud of the fact I pardoned those people.
The power of the
pardon. And the Congress couldn't do a damn thing about it. I loved it.
Like Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter before him, George Herbert Walker Bush was forced to sit on the platform as the man who defeated him, Bill Clinton, took over the job of president. It's a symbol, says the former president, of the continuity provided by the Constitution.
We should never take for granted that aspect of our system, you know, transfer of power from one party to another, one president to another. It's stabilizing. And I'm a great believer in the two-party system. That's not embodied in the Constitution, but I think it should get some credit for real stability. These third-party things all fizzle out, and they deserve to, in my view.
Still, admits Bush, it was tough to lose.
You stand there in the White House door to greet the new president and his wife. It was not without pain. We loved the people that worked in the White House. But then the Lord works in mysterious ways. 8 years later, I walk back into the West Wing of the White House as the guest of the new president of the United States, and we were greeted by that staff with a warmth, civil servants, with a warmth and affection, just like it was your own kids. Out of the sorrow of defeat comes wonderful things. In the Bush family's case, we could not be happier.
Former president and father, George Herbert Walker Bush, I'm Cokie Roberts.
Check your local public television and radio listings for the entire George W. Bush interview, which you can also hear at npr.org.